Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. My name is Dan Safarik. My co-host Greg Lindsay will be joining us midstream, hopefully. The guest today is Jorge Almazan. He is one of the authors of Emergent Tokyo, Designing the Spontaneous City. This is a small guidebook, small-sized guidebook, to the city, some of the more unexpected aspects, drawing some lessons from this famously chaotic city that I think are pretty unique and perhaps applicable to other cities. So I'd like to welcome you, Jorge. Thank you for joining Unfrozen today.
Thank you.
So Emergent Tokyo, Designing the Spontaneous City, what sort of gave you the idea to get started in a book like this?
Yeah, well, I'm a long-term resident of Tokyo. I'm a researcher, an architect, and have been here for, it's going to be almost 20 years next year. So, I think there was really a lack of I would say, updated information on the city. And I felt always that dominant narratives on the city were kind of being repeated over the decades. So I think that there was a need really to give to an international audience or English-speaking audience a more updated view and maybe even a critical view on the city. So for example, you mentioned chaotic, unique. I mean, these are keywords that almost always appear when we talk about Tokyo. And why is it so? What are the stories behind that, you know, made us almost always repeat those two adjectives when we talk about the city? And the book you mentioned is a guidebook, yeah, but it's also a kind of manifesto in favor of the spontaneous city. And well, the main idea is that rather than chaotic, maybe more from a contemporary viewpoint, we can think of Tokyo rather as an emergent city. So I'm sure that many of, those who are listening to us now know this concept of emergence, which means it's a concept from the complexity science, which means systems or phenomena which create order and functionality from the bottom up. So there is no such a top-down order, or there is no central brain that coordinates everything. And many of the interesting phenomena that many of us have been describing, I include myself for many years, as chaotic, I think could be better described as emergent. And the next step would be like, okay, then what is the role of the architect if it's self-organized? And this is another point of the book, is that in fact, we can design this kind of disorder. We can design the spontaneous city if we look at specific conditions and dimensions and morphologies. And the book is really a description of those morphologies across Tokyo.
Right, and some of these are pretty distinct and will be familiar to people who have visited, but probably not by name, at least if you are just a casual foreign visitor. You would have to probably live there to have acquired some of these names. I wasn't familiar with any of these classifications, so perhaps we can go through them one by one for the benefit of the listeners. One of the typologies that you identify is a Yokocho alleyway. And then there is a Zakyo building and Ankyo streets. So maybe we can tell us about those three first. The other typologies are a little bit more relatable in the because they obviously have English names. But let's talk about the ones that are sourced in local vernacular.
Yeah. Yokocho alleyways, this word Yokocho, means clusters of micro-scale bars and restaurants that, you can find along tiny alleyways. Probably now, every tourist that goes to Tokyo has been in Golden Gai in Shinjuku, So maybe some of you might be familiar with this kind of micro-scale bar districts. Many of them have origins in black markets, post-war black markets, which were relocated into the current location. And they are really interesting because they are super tiny, but at the same time, they are very diverse, very lively, and they have an amazing identity as a place. So, you know, Golden Guy has a clear identity. Other examples that we show in the book also have a clear identity. So it's again like small units, small elements that working together, they create something which is much more than the sum of its parts. Well, zakyo buildings, zakyo means in Japanese something like coexistent mixture, and are those multi-story, multi-tenant buildings that I'm sure that everyone has seen in movies, is those buildings which tend to sit on very narrow plots, but at the same time are very vertical, and also very typically they have this neon signage, vertical neon signage. And the interesting story about them is that you can find almost any kind of program inside. So you can find a clinic, a restaurant, language school, a hostess bar, a church. I mean, the wildest combination of, things can be stacked on top of each other. And those create almost like a vertical yokocho, I would say. It's almost, I would say, that the verticalized version of the yokocho that I mentioned previously. And I think you mentioned also the last one would be the Ankyo streets. Ankyo means covered rivers. And we can find in Tokyo that many of the most interesting streets, and by interesting, I mean lively and with different usage and, like surprising kind of elements. Many of them have been rivers in the past and were basically covered for the, not the last Olympics, but the previous Olympics in 64. And all of a sudden, the city had like a network of new streets, many of them very long and crossing along through different blocks in the city, which were basically unnecessary as streets. And therefore, citizens and people living along the streets and shops, etc., they started to colonize them and put in furniture and reusing them, and then became almost like a kind of, I would say, bottom-up design. Ankyo streets can be very different, can be become like hidden routes across the city, or sometimes they can become more like a public boulevard. It's very diverse, but they share this condition of being a bottom-up design street. Maybe the most famous case, I would say, is in Jiugaoka, which is a station along the Tohoyoko line. It's a line between Shibuya and, well, those who know Tokyo, Shibuya, let's say, between the south part of Tokyo and Yokohama, more or less in between. And it's amazing the number of benches and activities happening there. And that's because, precisely because it had this degree of freedom because of being an Ankyo street.
Thank you for that explanation. And it seems that Greg has now joined us, and I believe he'd like to ask a question.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen, as it happens to be here in Montreal. Sorry to be joining midstream, but here I am. It's fascinating. The yokocho, I love that typology. And you're right. That what you describe as a vertical yokocho is like my favorite expression of Tokyo urbanism, that it could be completely mashed up uses. But I'm curious if you could talk a bit about the historical circumstances, particularly obviously after the U.S. firebombing of Tokyo in 1945. That led to this sort of emergent state. I've read academic papers and I've heard it described by the founders of Urbs in Dharavi in Mumbai, that Tokyo in a way is sort of like the ultimate expression of the informal emergent city. But that it was able to do so because somehow they had preserved the property record so that everyone had had clean title on their land, but that the authorities sort of relaxed the zoning to nothing so that people could build almost anything they wanted. And this incredible expression of post-war Tokyo emerged. I don't know if that's the true story or not, but I was hoping you could talk a bit about, yeah, the unique expressions of this and what lessons Tokyo hold for other global, I mean, well, not other, but global South megacities that have this mashup of uses, but still struggle with a lot of informality, particularly when it comes to housing.
Yeah, that's a great, that's a really great point, very important. In fact, I mean, Yokocho, not the vertical Yokocho, but the horizontal Yokocho, they are really like the result of post-war policy, and specifically about what the Japanese called GHQ, the General Headquarters, the American Occupation Policy. The American occupation forces found that after the war, immediately in front of almost all stations in Tokyo, even central station and suburban stations, they found that many returnee soldiers and even people, I mean, normal residents of Tokyo, they created black markets. They were rationing food, but it was not enough. So as it always happens in these situations, they were like, black markets in those stations, around those stations. The policy was to dismantle those black markets, but instead of just forbidding them, what they did is to relocate them into different types of buildings. And what we see today in Yokocho is one of those types, one of the relocation buildings, because there were more, but they have disappeared to a great extent. I think what we see now as Yokocho are these row houses, what we call Nagaya, is kind of row houses, very simple, but they have still survived, or they are still surviving. And what you mentioned is very important, because the policy, and I read in several sources that it was really coming from this general headquarters, from the American forces, was to give to each tenant or to each business an equal part of the land. So they were relocated, but each business, each small black marketeer received the same amount, and even if it was very small. So what we see now, the micro scale of these bar districts, or the micro scale, is really the result of authorities subdividing the land in equal parts. Even if they were very tiny, the idea that was that everyone should have access to property and have the possibility of develop their own, even if it's tiny, but their own business. And of course, that situation was at the beginning of the post-war period, but immediately after, of course, authorities started to do like infrastructural work. And that infrastructure was basically based on building roads across the city, and on train infrastructure, which is, of course, very impressive now in Tokyo. So I think there is a combination of, let's say, post-war spontaneous development combined with a very clear policy to give equal plots of land to everyone as much as possible, which was coming really from basically from the occupation forces. And also later, I would say, a kind of light planning approach approach to urban planning, which was focused rather on hard infrastructure, trains, big avenues, etc. And this combination kind of managed to keep, I would say, or combine the liveliness of the informal city together with an infrastructure that worked very well, and possibilities of trying to distribute land access and property access to as many businesses and as many families as possible. I think that's a kind of very interesting combination. And sure, I think that there are many things not only that we can, I mean, that cities in the global south can learn, but even I would say the so-called Western cities, I think they could also benefit from this kind of approach or this kind of inspiration.
Yeah, I like the idea of the sort of improvisation within the theme, right? So you have a basic infrastructure that is very functional, but you don't necessarily have a top-down planning regime, you know, saying that you have to have this type of use in this district and this type of use in another district. That things are very sort of allowed to gestate a little bit organically. And the other thing that I think is sort of counterintuitive about Tokyo as compared to other Asian cities is that, you know, it is largely, it's a lot of single family homes that are constructed of, you know, balloon frames, sort of like Los Angeles. I sometimes think, even though it commonly gets compared to New York, it's really more like Los Angeles in that way. You have a lot of buildings, you have a lot of very closely spaced single family homes. The difference being that the infrastructure in Tokyo is so much more rail centric. Even though they have rammed through a lot of expressways and that type of thing. What do you think about the morphology of Tokyo? What does that have to teach other cities?
Well, yeah, I mean, this what you mentioned now is also one of the morphologies that we address in the book, which is the dense, low-rise neighborhoods. And well, maybe someone who visits Tokyo for the first time, his or her impression is that these are really not working because they seem to be like crowded. It's a residential detached typology, which happens to be like so close together without almost, apparently without gardens. The first impression would be like negative. But once one lives in these neighborhoods, one can discover that they are really incredibly livable. Of course, there are many problems, but I would say that there are like, again, like emergent properties that help them to become so livable. One, of course, not everything is emergent, as you mentioned. One important feature is that the connection to the city center is so good. So in less than 1 hour, you can be in the one of the centers of Tokyo, because Tokyo is a polycentric city, and have access to any kind of services and cultural facilities, etc. But then you can live in a relatively quiet neighborhood in which children can play outside, in which you can have your own small business open in the first floor of your house, because zoning is not so strict as in other countries. And again, this property of being emergent, this kind of spontaneous usage of the street. To give you one example, for example, many of the small spaces between houses and even in front of the houses, if you walk through these neighborhoods, you can see that there are lots of plants and lots of greenery. And that greenery is managed and by the residents themselves. So there is no kind of regulation that obliges them to have a garden. And so everyone kind of contributes to the neighborhood by putting those plants and trees, etc., these micro gardens. And as a whole, the neighborhood really feels and has an important presence of greenery. There are many advantages. For example, the fact that much of the buildings are made in wood also makes them really easy to renovate. And we can see continuously these neighborhoods changing, to use a word that is almost like traditional in the Japanese context, metabolizing, continuously metabolizing and changing, but always within that small scale. So there is a kind of, it's easy for people to open small shops, to transform their houses, in that small scale because it requires a like small capital. You don't need like huge capital to do it. And then there is this common sense of or shared sense of a neighborhood expressed pretty much through this greenery, this small greenery. So I would say in the particular context of Tokyo, if you go a little bit beyond the large avenues and big streets, which are the places that most tourists visit, you will find immediately this small scale where you see children outside playing, the elderly talking. It's almost like being in a village in the middle of a megalopolis. That's really the main advantage, I would say, of this morphology.
And you would argue, I think, that the small scale contexts are the ones that actually work the best in Tokyo and are most perhaps exportable, and maybe the larger scale urban interventions like Roppongi Hills and the like maybe are a little bit not so great to export, or do you feel like they are imported from somewhere else?
Well, you mentioned Roppongi Hills in particular. I think, well, in this particular case, it's actually quite imported because, I mean, the designers, if I'm not wrong, is KPF. And the shopping mall at the ground is made by Jan Yerde, I'm not sure of the pronunciation. So anyway, like they're like foreign companies. And I think the way of thinking is also kind of, I would say, exchangeable. It's almost like any city has this kind of skyscrapers combined with a podium or a lower part of a shopping mall. So I think it's really, that's not really maybe the part where the lessons, the most important lessons we can find from Tokyo, because basically we can find similar developments almost in any other city, I would say, or any other global city. So I would say, yeah, the small scale is probably where we can find the most important lessons for other cities.
I want to come back to the question I'd asked earlier. Since you're discussing smaller scale and its lessons elsewhere, you know, obviously the book is Emergent Tokyo, and you draw this you draw a dichotomy between emergence and chaos, which I think is wonderful, of course, because for, you know, dyed-in-the-wool urbanists listening to this, like, emergence was a property that Jane Jacobs herself was obsessed with. It's the hallmark of complexity science. We've seen complexity scientists like Jeffrey West and Luis Betancourt start to delve with the idea of, like, what is a city as a system and how does it perform? And I was curious if you could talk a bit more about that emergence, because I think you also mentioned in the book Stephen Wolfram, who I went to school at Illinois, so Wolfram was a presence there, and his obsession with cellular automata, this idea that you could have very simple conditions that produce complex outcomes. So I'm curious about, I guess as a way of wrapping up this question, about, you know, you talked earlier about General Headquarters and the conditions that the American occupation set that produced this outcome. Are there lessons for other cities there, or what is it, what does Tokyo teach us about the fundamental notion of what a city is or can be? Because it seems like sort of the city that way.
Well, yeah, that's a really important question. And well, the subtitle of the book is Designing the Spontaneous City, so which seems to be like a contradiction in terms. But I think it's really important because by the end, the question is how can we design those that desirable chaos or emergence, right? So you mentioned cellular automata, and I think it is important research, but it's still like very abstract for an architect or for an urban designer. I would say probably we need to learn from cities in their actual condition rather than through software. That is one approach, of course, and we can learn through you know, like computing, etc., and simulation. But I think it's also important to look at cities as they are, really, and see how this theory of complexity can help us to understand it, understand them in a more useful way. So I don't use this complexity theory in a formal way. So the reader is not going to find like mathematical formula or software simulations, etc. It's more on an inspirational level, I would say, or philosophical level, how to approach or how to look at phenomena. You mentioned the general headquarters and how they influence the design of Tokyo. So I would say what we really can learn from Tokyo, and hopefully this book contributes, is how this emergence, maybe we cannot design emergence in itself, but we can design the conditions for emergence to occur. Well, to happen.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question, because that question, I mean, that's been dealt with recently in books by Richard Sennett. I think that's actually called The Uses of Disorder, or we're getting into that. Like, how do we design that scaffolding, that architecture truly, but yeah, I mean, also regulatory infrastructure and things like this. So are there any abstractable lessons for those cities? Because what you speak of there, you mentioned sort of looking at it in practice. I mean, there's people like Shlomo Sali Angel, who worked on a pattern language with Christopher Alexander, who's now doing work in the Global South to lay out infrastructure for miles around so that megacities can grow. We see Paul Romer, the economist, working with the economics ideas of Jane Jacobs, trying to do charter cities from scratch. Like, is Tokyo a model to help us crack, like, the idea of creating instant cities, or to help us create, new cities faster, or new districts of cities faster? People try to go back to the high modernist city, but it strikes me that this is a much more flexible kit of parts to work with, or at least the building blocks we should be working with.
Yeah. I mean, all these names that you mentioned that are really important, of course, they are the pioneers, and they have influenced this book, of course. Jane Jacobs and Christopher Alexander, etc., pattern language. I wouldn't kind of be too worried about creating a kind of a new overall theory of emergent urbanism. I would say each case is quite different. So I think rather than thinking of kind of generalizing principles, I would say more, I prefer the concept of transferring principles. So transferability of theory maybe is a better approach, because try to create in universal principles for cities, I think, is kind of sometimes could be a kind of dangerous. But even though the book at the end tries to create or contribute to this discussion, because it's very important, this tension between concrete terms and more abstract theory. And we kind of compare what we call corporate-led Tokyo. Some authors would name it neoliberal Tokyo, with emergent Tokyo, and at least compare those two and see how we can extract like more abstract kind of conclusions. So our conclusions is that numerous owners instead of single large corporations, and using economies of agglomeration instead of economies of scale, promoting small scale rather than the large scale, promoting inclusive boundaries when designing the blocks and permeability, using networks instead of hierarchies, and try to think of the city as in incremental steps rather than this kind of cataclysmic mega redevelopments that we see everywhere in the world. Those could be some of the very abstract principles that could inspire other cities. I would say I think we need to take more like a case study approach and kind of find examples that really represent this kind of emergent urbanism. And well, you mentioned, for example, the issue of speed. How can we produce this fast? Well, for example, Golden Guy, the example that I mentioned at the beginning, this is one of the Yokocho, is now like a super famous place, and it has like a really resilient identity. And it's in the middle of Shinjuku, in the middle of probably one of the most expensive real estate areas in the world. But still you have like this low-rise area, very lively, etc. I think that place it's relatively young, or it's in fact very young because it was created after the war. So it's has what, I mean, it's maybe 60 years, but has such a strong identity. So how can we produce those places with a very strong entity or urban intensity in such a small amount of time? Well, maybe Golden Guy could be one example. So maybe doesn't need to be bars. Maybe we can create like kind of incubation of companies, for example, or young entrepreneurs instead of bars, or could be even used for housing or co-housing. So there are like many ways in which architects can be inspired from specific cases, but I would kind of avoid creating like large universal theories and think more of terms in terms of transferability of knowledge from specific context to another specific context, rather without even passing too much into the universal kind of layer of theory, which at sometimes can be, or at least this is what we saw in the modernism, could be sometimes dangerous and pernicious in some cases.
And since you've mentioned the Golden Guy, I would be remiss if I did not ask for your favorite bar recommendation.
Okay, so maybe from the book that, I mean, I would recommend from the cases that we included in the book. For example, one, I think people are in, at least in the US, or people who watch Netflix are quite familiar with Midtime Diner, this series of small bar in the middle of Shinjuku. You can find a very similar place. It's called Usagi, Bar Usagi. It means rabbit. It's really cozy. It's in this case, it's in Shibuya. And the owner is a young woman, a young entrepreneur. And you can really feel, you know, this kind of home style cooking. I think she doesn't speak English much, but she told me that half or her clientele were foreigners. So somehow there is some kind of universal way of communicating there. It's really small. I think it's like 7 feet by 7 feet in the footprint. It's like really small, but still you feel this coziness. That's one of my recommendations. The other one I think would be like in Yanagi-koji. Yanagi-koji is the name of one of these, another Yokocho included in the book. It's on the Chuo line. One of the main lines that cross, that go through Tokyo from the west to the east, almost straight. It's in the station called Nishiyogikubo. And this is even smaller. This is like 5 feet by 10 feet almost. It's called the Greek Bar. It's run by a Greek young chef, and it's interesting because the whole Yokocho has an important presence of foreign restaurants and foreign bars, and I think it's very interesting to see like how foreigners and immigrants or people with an international background are now kind of starting to use those small spaces and contributing to the liveliness of the place. So I would say those two, one which is like super Japanese and the other which is shows more like a let's say more international character. Usagi in Shibuya and the Greek bar in Nishiyogikubo. That would be my two recommendations.
Well, thank you. That was the entire objective of my podcast this afternoon. I'm just kidding. We have great admiration for small scale bars like that are very idiosyncratic, that are very personalized. And I actually do think that is a good example of something that is an easily exportable model where perhaps other types of uses might not be. The closest analog that I have experienced to the Golden Guy outside of Tokyo is actually in Shanghai, which is a street called Yongkang Road, which appeals both to foreigners and to Chinese, but is a very narrow street with a lot of idiosyncratic businesses that are always changing. A lot of people living above the shop, sometimes living in the shop, and all kinds of lively street life and just improvisation. You know, if a bar wanted to serve food and they didn't have a kitchen, they would contract with someone who drives an electric bike to deliver food from a kitchen somewhere else off the property, you know, because either the regulations wouldn't permit them to do it or they just physically didn't have enough space. So I like these infrastructures that allow for improvisation. Now, of course, this being China, you know, it was subject to political winds sometimes, and the whole neighborhood would get cleansed and shut down occasionally because, you know, the wrong official got angry about one thing or the other. And then all of a sudden they'd be replaced with other businesses. But it was a good example of that kind of, you've got the hard infrastructure surrounding it, the good bones, but they're good bones on a loose framework, I guess you could say. Probably more so in Tokyo than in Shanghai, which is still sort of experimenting with that kind of improvisational urbanism.
Yeah, I mean that's really important. I think the capacity of incubation of these places is very important, because you can start with a small budget and you can experiment and in a very central place, right? So that's really important. I think another value of these places is that they are like third places. You know, this concept of Oldenburg's concept, this sociologist, American sociologist, this concept of a place between home and the work, where you can go there and socialize. So they are, I mean, both positive, I think, from economic viewpoint, but also from a sociological viewpoint. And yeah, I think it's the kind of exportable. I would say, I am from Spain originally. I would say it is not necessarily absolutely kind of uniquely Japanese, because we can find also like very tiny bars and restaurants also in South European countries. But the trend now is to large franchises and you know, we are kind of losing this kind of idiosyncratic, very unique spaces. And I think this Yokocho structure really works a kind of incubator for diversity. And I think that's something that could benefit cities all over the world.
And certainly it's the idea, you know, not only space constraints, but, you know, the idea that, you know, there's a sort of collective idea of being out in public and doing a lot of things in public. It's a very public society, but also, you know, it's both ordered and chaotic, I guess you could say. Maybe chaotic is the word we should stop using. you know, it's ordered but emergent. You don't have to worry about, you know, crime and all this kind of thing. You know, it's a very polite society largely, but one that has probably more room for improvisation than you would probably assume. And it's quite interesting to see that reflected on a real architectural analysis. And actually, to get to that point, what kind of books did you take inspiration from? Guidebooks, other types of books in the execution of this, not only from the content perspective, but also the representation. You know, I love these little axonometric diagrams that show all the figures and the exact dimensions of these small businesses and these improvised spaces amongst the massive infrastructure. How did you arrive at the representation model for these neighborhoods, these typologies?
Well, yeah, the book is very graphic, although it has also like a good amount of text also. One criteria for us when we wanted to choose or address or find what kind of elements or typologies we were going to consider in detail or take as study cases was our ability to draw them or not. I mean, if we can draw them, if we can visualize them, then maybe it's easy or easier to address them from an architectural viewpoint or from a design viewpoint. So being able to draw was a very important point for us. And specifically the axonometric drawings, this is something that you can find a lot in Japan. I would say the most famous maybe book abroad is Made in Tokyo by Atelier Bauwa. One of them, Yoshiharu Tsukamoto, was my supervisor for my PhD here in Tokyo. And when I found here, when I came, is that that kind of drawing was really almost like the dominant way of drawing in the whole school where I was doing my PhD. So I would say the main inspiration would be like for the drawings would be like Made in Tokyo. But those who know this book, maybe they will remember that the drawings were basically about buildings only. It was like hybrid buildings found across Tokyo. And what we wanted to add was the activities. So we included people in the drawings. And also we wanted to add the context, the urban context. Therefore, they are like spreads. We use like two-page drawings, including the overall view of the context, the surrounding streets, the presence of other elements, cars, greenery, etc., everything that surrounds the building. So that was probably our contribution, adding people and adding context to this kind of long tradition of axonometric drawing that we can find in Japan.
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed the multi-angle, multi-spatial analysis. Did you look at books like Cities Without Ground or other diagrammatic examinations of Asian cities?
Yes, I know the book. It was not a direct inspiration, but I must say the main reason why we contacted this publisher, Oro Editions, was because I saw this book and I saw that they were kind of interested in this kind of very graphical books, and also the quality of the drawings. It's not so easy to get like really beautiful and thin lines, precise lines in print. Oro Editions had this ability, and they show it in Cities Without Ground, which is a very important, very interesting book. Rather than a direct inspiration, was almost like our way to get in contact with Oro Editions, and I think also they did a great work again, and I think we managed to print it quite nicely this time too.
Yeah, it's a lovely size. It's a portable volume. It's perhaps about 6 by 4 inches, just big enough to fit in a raincoat pocket or something like that as you're traipsing about town. I always give guidebook authors trouble when they publish a guidebook that is larger than a standard, A4 or 8.5 by 11 format. It's like, well, how are you going to carry that around?
Yeah.
You know, is this practical for field work, or is this meant to simply be for the armchair? And it actually sort of works for both, because you can appreciate the level of detail, but it's small enough that you can take it around. These analog pleasures we have, we have to find them where we can. Jorge Almazan, Studio Lab, Emergent Tokyo, Designing the Spontaneous City on Unfrozen.
Thank you so much.